Let me just say again, this has just been a wonderful experience. And some folks have kind of come up hesitantly and say, you know, do you mind if we ask you questions? And I love it. I love the questions that you're asking. They're thoughtful, they're reflective, they're not angry, they're not hurtful. They're actually just wonderful questions that you're asking. So I really appreciate the conversations that I've been able to have with a number of folks at this conference. Because I didn't get to a couple of slides at the end, I kind of built up Acts chapter 15 and talked about the context of Acts 15, but didn't quite get to the explanation of what happens in Acts 15 and how that provides for us the context for our ministry now. I thought I'll just take the first 5-10 minutes to talk about that, and then I want to talk about 1 Peter 2. In the first morning session, we were trying to just set the setting. What's going on in the world around us? What's going on in our communities, in our neighborhoods? And then now, this evening, we want to talk about what are some of the responses that the church can offer. And just like this morning, I'll probably try to finish up a little bit earlier and offer 10, 15, 20 minutes and a chance for us to have some question and answer and interact with some of the material out there as well. So this morning, I talked about the ways that the church was changing and how it was reflective of Acts 15 and what was going on in the church in Acts 15. So today, I want to look at tonight I want to look at one of the responses that occurred in Acts chapter 15, verse 2 through 4. It says that Peter and Barnabas were appointed to go up to Jerusalem. The church sent them on their way, and as they traveled through Phoenicia and Samaria, they told how the Gentiles had been converted. The news made all the believers very glad. When they came to Jerusalem, they were welcomed by the church and the apostles and elders, to whom they reported everything that God had done through them. Now, the situation in Jerusalem was such that there was a little bit of a fear that was developing. And I mentioned this morning that there was this transition from a Jewish Christianity to a more Gentile Christianity. And what that led to was that those who were the Judaizers, the Jewish Christians, were getting a little bit nervous about the changes that were occurring. And so the Judaizers made this statement. They said, if you want to become a Christian, you need to get circumcised first, which meant you need to convert to Judaism before you can convert to Christianity. So an added layer, an added set of expectations was put upon the Gentile believers. They said, you're a Gentile, you want to become a Christian. But in order for you to become a Christian, you must first become Jewish. So I was alluding to this a little bit this morning when I used the example of my Native American theologian, Richard Twiss, talking about how in the Native American communities, oftentimes they were told to convert to being a Westerner before they could convert to being a Christian, to take on the values of Western Christianity, such as shorter hair, changing their names to Western names, adapting the style of dress so that they couldn't wear their regalia. They had to wear suits and ties. They had to use organ music and classical music rather than using the Native American expressions of drumming and all the kind of Native expressions of worship. And so that would be a parallel to what was going on in Acts chapter 15, where the Judaizer says, you want to be a Christian, but first you must become Jewish. You want to be a Christian, first you must become a Westerner. First you must become an American. First you must become a white Western Christianer, and then we will accept you into the family of God. Now you can see how that's very problematic, because that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible doesn't teach us that we need to convert to something in order to become a follower of Jesus. It's one of the great things about being a Christian. We have a direct line to the gospel. We have a direct line to Jesus. We have a direct line to the Word of God itself, and we don't need to convert culturally to something else before we can become a follower of Jesus. And so two of the things that happens here, in order to address that problem, the problem that the Judaizers were saying, you want to be a Christian, you must first become Jewish in order to become a Christian. The first thing that happens here is that leaders are appointed. Paul and Barnabas are appointed. And they go out and they explore what's going on in the church. And they come back with great news of the Gentiles who are becoming believers. They come back and report to other leaders. And instead of saying, well, that's the strange stuff that those Gentiles over there are doing, what do? They embrace the work of God. And they say, this truly is the work of God, because the same Holy Spirit that has fallen upon us has also fallen upon these Gentiles. And so there is the acknowledgement by the leadership that there is some great work that God is doing. Some of it was not their work. Some of it was not their contrivance. They didn't really do anything to merit this, but God had done this work, and there was this acknowledgement of the good work that God was doing. So that's where I would kind of call us to think about what it would mean for us to embrace the work of God in what's happening in American Christianity and in global Christianity. What would it mean for leaders especially to say, this is actually the good work of God, and therefore instead of being fearful of the demographic changes, instead of being nervous about this diversity, to be able to say, this is the hand and work of God, and I want to embrace that because I want to be a part of God's work. Let me give you one example of how we could actually make this work. I've noticed that there's a couple of families who've done kind of cross-cultural adoptions. And I had a good friend who was doing a cross-cultural adoption. He was adopting an African child. It was a white family. And they made him go through this particular training I thought was fascinating. The training was that you had a whole bunch of marbles in front of you. And you were asked to pick out a color of a marble that reflected the answer to this particular question. So the questions were like this. Of the three magazines you have lying around your living room, what culture do they represent? Well, Better Homes and Gardens, okay, that's a white marble. Certain magazine, well, that's a white marble as well. So you were looking at the popular magazines that you're reading in your home tend to reflect a particular culture. Well, the type of foods you typically eat, or where do you go out for restaurants when you go out to eat? And, you know, oh, Olive Garden. No, that's not culture. I don't know what Olive Garden is, but it's not culture. That may reflect kind of a Americanized white culture, so I'll put another white marble in. And then you talk about, well, who are the people that the last three people you've had over to dinner? What was their racial, ethnic identity? Well, it turns out that the last three were white families, so you put that into your bowl. And then you say, okay, the last five books that you've read, Christian books, who are the authors? Well, it turns out that most of your authors that you've read, about Christian books especially, are white authors. So that at the end of a series of questions of the circumstances and life you've surrounded yourself with, the TV shows you watch, the magazines that you read, the people that you interact with, the type of restaurants you go out to eat, the people you have over at your house, at the end of it, you had an entire bowl of white marbles. And then they say, now take the color of the child you're about to adopt and put it in the middle of that bowl. And you can see what's going to happen. You have a bowl of white marbles, which is the world that you live in, the cultural context that you live in, and the influences of your community, the influences of your home, and then you put into that this one black marble in a sea of white marbles. And you can see how that might be very uncomfortable for that child in that particular context. It's a challenge for us to think about what are the influences that shape our lives. And one of the things I often challenge is, what are the last four or five Christian books that you've read? And who are the authors of these books? Several years ago, I was asked to speak at Wheaton College, and I said something that ended up being very controversial, and people wrote me hate mail and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things I said was, if you are a white American at Wheaton College, and you want to be a leader, especially in the area of missions. Wheaton has a long history of sending out missionaries. Billy Graham, Jim Elliot. There's some great missionaries and evangelists that have been raised up out of Wheaton College. And I said, I want to honor that of what's happened to Wheaton. But I said, if you're a white American now and you want to be a missionary, and given the cultural realities of the world right now, if you want to be a missionary and you've never had a non-white mentor, a non-white pastor or a non-white discipler in your life, you're not going to be a missionary. You're going to be a colonialist because you're going to colonize wherever country you go to with your brand of Christianity, which is not a biblical Christianity, but a cultural Christianity. So the challenge then is, where are the places in your life where the bowl is not all one color and you are embracing the diversity that God has brought into your life? The families that you have over, the museums that you visit, the books that you read, the histories that you learn about, all of these things reflect the cultural milieu that you are in, and is it reflective of one particular culture, or is it embracing the larger work of God that is an amazing global work? And that's what you see here, where the people of God are saying, this is a good work that God is doing, and we want to celebrate that. The second thing that happens here is that the people of God, this Jerusalem Council, decides that it is more important to talk about God's standards than human standards. It says here that that he accepted them by giving the Holy Spirit to them, just as he did to us. I already talked about this, verse 9. He made no distinction between us and them, for he purified their hearts by faith. Now then, why do you try to test God by putting on the necks of the disciples a yoke that neither we nor our fathers have been able to bear? No, we believe it is through the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ that we are saved, just as they are. So again, it is acknowledging our commonality with one another, that God is at work in these communities as much as God is at work in our communities. This is a concept that's coming more prominent in missiological studies. It's a concept of Missio Dei. And the word Missio Dei is a Latin word. It simply means the mission of God. And when you say the mission of God, it's actually a singular mission. When we talk about missions, we use it in the plural, right? We have a missions department. We have missions programs because there are mission agencies, and there are a lot of mission agencies. And so there is the home missions, and then there is the foreign missions, and we come up with a lot of different missions. And what that ends up causing us to think about is missions is a human effort to solve the world's problems. It is a human effort. The concept of Missio Dei is that there is God's mission, and that's it. Everything else falls under the jurisdiction of God's mission. In other words, God cares more about the lost than we ever could. God cares more about his word and his gospel going forth than we could ever even come close to that kind of ambition. For the word of God to go forth, God is more jealous and ambitious about that happening than we could ever hope to be. In other words, it is God's task and not our own. It is God's work and not our own. Which means this: God doesn't show up because we show up. God doesn't show up because the Western missionary shows up. God doesn't show up because Americans show up. God has always been there, revealing who he is through a lot of different ways, but he has always been at work. Do we believe that God is sovereign? Do we believe that God loves the world? And do we believe that God wants to reveal himself to the world? If that's true, then God has been doing this much longer than we've been doing it. And God has been there much longer than we've shown up. And so Missio Dei says, God is already at work in these communities. A part of it is drawing out the work of God and bringing us in partnership with where God has already been at work. So again, it's embracing the work of God and saying this is truly the work of God that is already at work even before we show up. And we can see this in immigrant communities, and we can see this in the churches, the new churches that are starting up. God doesn't just show up when we show up. God is already at work in these communities. So I want to shift now to, if we can go to the next set of slides, to the this idea of cultural intelligence. In my second book, I focus on cultural intelligence. What happened, I'll just kind of tell you the background of this book. It was called Many Colors, Cultural Intelligence for a Changing Church. I have a good friend who works for Moody Press, and he came up to me, and he knew that my first book was coming out. I had just finished it. It had just gone to press, and so he was trying to poach me from the other publishing company. So he comes up to me, and we actually were at the same church together, and he says, I have a great idea for a book that I want you to write. And he said, well, I just finished this. I actually wanted to take a break. No, we got to get this book out. And what he said was, this is a book we want to do on cultural intelligence or cultural competency. And what he was doing is he was looking at business schools and business books and finding that there were a lot of books about cultural intelligence in the business community. And those of you who work in the business community, especially if you work in international business, you know that this is language, and there are a lot of management books on this idea of cultural competence and cultural intelligence. And this is stuff that's been going on for 20, 30 years because we are in an extraordinarily global economy right now. And if you don't have cross-cultural competence, you're not going to be able to work with Asian businessmen or businesswomen. You're not going to be able to work with European financiers. You're not going to be able to work with Latin American companies. And so the idea of cultural competency has been in business communities for several decades now. And most of my resources in writing this book, aside from some of the scriptural stuff, really came from reading business texts that talked about cultural competency. So the business community has been way ahead of this for years and years, recognizing that you need cultural intelligence to make it in an extremely diverse world. And now the church is finally beginning to catch up and say, oh yeah, we need cultural intelligence to make it in this diverse Christianity. So that's the backdrop of the book. So when I started writing about the book, I was trying to understand behind the cultural competency issue, is a proper theology of culture, how we understand culture. Because the business community sees culture as kind of an expedient thing. You do it because out of a necessity. You understand another culture because you have to deal with Asian businessmen, Latin American industrialists. You have to understand it in order to function. But I think for Christians, we've got to think a little bit beyond the pragmatic and say it is a theology of culture that actually shapes how we interact cross-culturally. So I want to give a little bit out of my text about a theology of culture that helps us to understand cross-cultural. So moving from the situation, extraordinarily diversity and yet high levels of segregation, to, well, what can we do about it? And part of our motivation of what we can do about it really comes out of a healthy, robust, biblical theology of culture. So I want to do this by looking at 1 Peter. The book of 1 Peter is written by Peter to a community in mostly of churches that are in Turkey or Asia Minor at that time. And he's writing because a catastrophe has occurred in the city of Rome. How many of you heard the phrase, Rome burns, Nero fiddles while Rome burns? Have you heard that phrase before? So this is just kind of images I found on Google that tells us about how Nero fiddles while Rome burns. So what does it mean? Now, there really weren't violins back then, so he probably wasn't playing the violin. He was probably playing some kind of instrument like that. But the idea is that the city of Rome is burning and Nero doesn't care. He's just kind of playing a musical instrument. I'm happy that the city is burning. Well, why would Nero be happy that the city is burning? Because he actually might have set the fires himself. Because he wanted to rebuild that entire city. And the way he was going to rebuild the city is by burning off parts of that city so he can now put, you know, a target there instead of, subsidized housing. So it was a very shrewd move on his part. Burn up part of the city, and then now I can put my shopping center in there. So what happens, though, is that people get very suspicious about how those fires are set. CSI Rome comes in and investigates the scene of the crime, and they look through the forensic evidence and say, wait a minute, this is very suspicious here. This is not Mrs. O'Leary's cow knocking over a lantern. There's something really fishy going on. And so Nero says, okay, I have got to deflect attention away from myself. People are getting suspicious. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick a group of people that are the most outcast, bizarre group of people in my city. And listen to how bizarre this group was. This group did some crazy, crazy things. It was believed that they were cannibals because they ate and drank the body and blood of their founder. Crazy, crazy stuff. They were cannibals eating the flesh and drinking the blood of their founders. There was accusations of incest because they would call each other brother and sister. And it turns out they were actually married to each other. So did they marry their brothers and sisters? It was really bizarre stuff. And maybe worst of all, they were probably communists because they held everything in common and they shared with those that had need and gave to the poor and they shared those things. So really, these were the craziest, kookiest people in the world. Who were they? The Christians. Yeah, they were the Christians. And the Christians, because of some of the practices they lived and some of the things that they did, were considered to be the crazy people, ostracized, alienated people. So Nero said, this is the perfect target. Nobody's going to care if the Christians are persecuted. And so Nero brutally persecuted them. This is not accurate because this didn't happen simultaneously. But we hear the stories of Christians who were martyred by wild animals. And oftentimes they had meat tied to them, live flesh tied to them. And then the wild animals would come and devour them. One of the more brutal things that he did is that he dipped Christians in tar. And then he would use them as garden torches in his garden. He would wrap Christians up in leather sacks and then throw them into the river. And then the leather sacks would contract. And so they would both suffocate and drown at the same time. He would drag Christians through the city behind them and drag their bodies to show, you don't mess with me. I'm making an example of these people. They set the fire. So what happens is that this persecution in Rome, people hear about it. You know, you can't keep that silent for long. Now, historians have gone back and looked at this story and said, actually, the persecution was not as brutal as some of the subsequent persecution by other Roman emperors. It was probably localized. It was probably under 100 people. Now, that's not good, but compared to some of the other persecutions that occurred later on, it was a relatively small number. But it was one of the more brutal persecutions. So Nero did a very strategic thing. He picked out a small group and really brutalized that group so that the word would spread, this is how we treat those who are Christians. So word spreads not just in the city of Rome, but it reaches Asia Minor. It reaches other parts of the Roman Empire. And now these Christians who are in Asia Minor, who think about it, were not actually victims and were not actually the ones who got persecuted, but they heard about the persecution. And they hear about this persecution and they say, we want to have nothing to do with this messed up society. We want to have nothing to do with the world that hates us. And so the temptation that the people of God are facing, that Peter is writing to, are not actual victims of persecution, but they're grappling with the idea, this culture is evil, therefore we need to withdraw from the culture. We need to not engage with the evil world that is out there, but instead pull back and not engage with the world. And it is in that context that Peter writes this letter, to actually tell them, don't do it. Don't disengage from the culture. Don't back away. Don't run away from the world around you. Don't be afraid of what's going on, but instead seek the peace of the community that God has called you to. In fact, it's believed by some scholars that 1 Peter is actually, if you look at the structure, it follows very much Jeremiah chapter 29. The outline of Jeremiah chapter 29 is very similar to 1 Peter. And it's believed that Peter took Jeremiah 29 and just rewrote it with using that structure to tell kind of the same message. And Jeremiah 29, as you might know, is the passage that says, I have sent you into exile into Babylon, but don't be afraid. Seek the peace, not of Jerusalem, but of Babylon. The most wicked city in the world, I want you to seek the peace of that city. So that same message is now recapitulated in 1 Peter. It says, no, don't run away from Rome, this wicked city. Instead, engage the culture that you've been called into. This story is a wonderful challenge for us in the 20th and 21st century. Because in the 20th century, there was a real fear by Christians of what was going on in the world around them. The world seemed evil and antagonistic. One of the case studies on this is the Scopes trial in the 1920s. And that was the trial of the century. All the news reports went all over the United States. And it was the story of John Scopes, who was a Tennessee school teacher, who was put on trial for teaching evolution. And a Christian lawyer came down to prosecute John Scopes. His name was William Jennings Bryan, who actually ran for president as a democratic socialist, but he was also a fundamentalist Christian. So he was very devout and believed in the creationist account and didn't want the evolution account taught in the school system. And so they had this trial between William Jennings Bryan, who was the fundamentalist, versus Clarence Darrow, who was the humanist, who was defending John Scopes. Well, it turns out the trial was actually won by William Jennings Bryan, but in the court of public opinion, the Christians came off looking stupid. Because the reporters that were reporting this news, particularly H.L. Mencken of the Baltimore Sun, really portrayed Bryan, the Christian, in a very negative light. These people are ignorant. These people are backwater, stupid Christians who know nothing about science, and they don't know anything. And so that's the message that got out in the media. And so the Christian saw this and heard this and says, we want to have nothing to do with the world out there. The world is against us. It reports bad things about us. So Christians in the 20th century began to withdraw from the society and seize culture as evil and form their own subculture in contrast to the evil world. And the Scopes trial will be one of those examples. Well, one of the ways that you see this is in church architecture. If you see churches, and I don't know if you see this in California, but you see a lot of this in the Midwest, churches that were built in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, up until about the 70s and 80s, you see a lot of churches that have this kind of architecture. You don't quite see it here, but you see a lot more of the slanted roof and a little bit of an arch on the side. So you can see kind of some examples of this here. You can see it a little bit better here. How many of you have seen church buildings that look like this? Yeah, you've seen. This is very common. Now, when I was a kid, I saw our church building, this was in the late 70s, early 80s, and our church building was being dedicated. And I was looking at this and saying, why do we build our church buildings like that? Because if you look at it, it is very inefficient, especially if you live in the Midwest or in the Northeast. What happens there in the winter? It gets really cold, right? And what happens to all the hot air? It goes up right into the rafters, right? So what do you have to do? You have to install ceiling fans, right? To push the hot air down. And what happens if you install ceiling fans? Charismatics can't worship in that church. You know, it doesn't work. So what you end up with are highly inefficient church sanctuary buildings that operate more symbolically than functionally. So I was wondering, why would churches build buildings like this? Why would you have inefficient use of space? And then I went to a building dedication of a church, and the pastor said, I want everybody to look up into the ceiling and look up into the rafters. And I want everybody to imagine this entire building turned upside down. All right, what does that look like? It looks like the bottom of a boat. And he actually said, this church is a boat. And he said, where in the Bible do you read about a boat? A really big boat. Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark. So what you see in Noah's Ark is the story of what we see ourselves as a church. Now think about the theological symbolic implication of Noah's Ark. If you are Noah's Ark, what are you saying to the culture out there? We don't care about you. We actually are expecting you to be destroyed. We actually want the judgment of God to come upon you because we're safe right here in Noah's Ark. And we've created our little own microcosm of the world out there. So we have a little subculture that's going on out there, but we don't care about the world as long as we're safe in Noah's Ark. So if there is a secular version, we're going to make a Christian version right here in Noah's Ark. If there is secular music, we will have Christian music, usually a very poor version of secular music. If there's secular art, we will have Christian art. If there's secular colleges, we will have Christian colleges. If there is secular anything, coloring books, we will have Christian coloring book. If there are secular crayons, we will have Christian crayons. Secular stuffed animals, Christian stuffed animals. And you start developing a subculture that says, we don't care about the world out there as long as we've got our own little community here. Now, how do you do evangelism out of Noah's Ark? Well, you might have a life raft or one of those life circle things. And, hey, there's Uncle Joe. Hey, we got to bring him on. Come on, let's throw a lifeline out there and bring Uncle Joe on. So Uncle Joe is now on the boat. And then a neighbor comes by. You know, he borrowed my lawnmower about a month ago. He still hasn't given it back. So we'll just let him float away. So you get to pick and choose who you want on your ark. And that's oftentimes is the way we've done evangelism and church growth. We pick and choose who we want in our church. And it's usually people that look like us, that we like, our family members or people that are in the same socioeconomic class, our neighbors that we like, but not the neighbors that we don't like. We pick and choose who we want in our ark. And what that does is it disengages us from the culture around us. And it creates this idea that the culture is evil as long as we have a good culture in Noah's Ark. We don't really care about what's going on in the world out there. Well, this is problematic, as we find out in the rest of the passage. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 through 12, Peter challenges the people, the Christians in Asia Minor, that I want you to be aliens and strangers in the world. Now, the first part of that, alien, we're going to set aside for now. I want to talk about the word stranger. Now, that makes sense to many of us, right? We want to be strangers to, as it says, evil things that are going on in the world. We want to be strangers to that. And that makes sense. Be strangers in the world and abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Okay, that makes sense. We can think about all the wrong and evil influences in the world, and we want to be protected from that by saying we want to be strangers. You know, we don't want to live like the really evil people in the world. We don't want to be murderers and all these bad things. So we want to abstain from those things by being strangers to sin that is in the world. Now, most people have interpreted this and said, we are strangers and aliens, and have assumed that those two words mean the exact same thing, right? They're synonyms. And if you do kind of a cursory reading, you say, oh yeah, aliens is stranger, right? Because you think, okay, a little green monster comes by, that's strange, so it's an alien and a stranger. Well, it turns out that's not what the word alien means. Stranger is what we think it is, be a stranger to the evil that is in the world. But the word alien there is actually not stranger, it's alien. But think of it as a better word, as in sometimes it says someone who's in exile or sojourner, or in some cases it actually is interpreted as immigrant, as an immigrant. So I thought of this and said, okay, what does it mean for me to be an immigrant? rather than an alien stranger, a strange alien. The word immigrant actually has a different connotation than strange alien. Because when I moved to the United States at the age of 6, we came in through the port of Seattle. They issued a card in my name. And they call it a green card, but it's actually beige. It's kind of a strange thing. It's not a green card, it's actually a beige card, but it's your permanent resident card. And it said on your card, resident alien or resident immigrant. Now here's what happens with a resident immigrant. You know that your citizenship is not in the United States. You know that, in my case, my citizenship is in Korea. But from the age of 6 on, to the age of 20, when I actually became a naturalized citizen, I was not a citizen of the United States. I was a resident immigrant. But did I not care about America? Of course I cared. I was in this country. I was living, in all intents and purposes, not as a full citizen, but as an immigrant that cared about my country at that moment in the United States. So that's the image that we see here. Because in this culture at this time, it's actually one of the first times in world history where you actually had immigration. You had people, because of the reach of the Roman Empire, you had people who were born in Corinth who might actually move to Antioch and live there as an adult. People who were born in Thessalonica who would move to Rome and live there as an adult. So you were actually having immigration. So the idea of being born somewhere else and having citizenship in another city or another state and then moving to another city and becoming an immigrant there was not uncommon. And that's why the second part of this is, if you are an alien, if you're a stranger, abstain from sinful desires, be strangers to these evil things. But if you're an immigrant, live good lives among the citizens of that nation so that they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds. So it's not separation from the world like a stranger. It is, in fact, a higher call to do more good than to do less good. Right? So this part is sinful desire abstain because you are a stranger, but you are an alien, therefore, an immigrant, therefore you actually need to live good lives in that culture. It is not a disengagement with that culture, it is actually a more active engagement with that culture, living good lives in that area and doing good deeds so that your God may be glorified. Do you see the distinction there between how a stranger interacts with the evil of the world and how an immigrant does good deeds and good works in the world? So what this calls us to is a more robust understanding of how the church engages with the culture around it. Because for many years, as I was mentioning about the Noah's Ark thing, the church disengaged from the culture and acted in very antagonistic ways towards the culture. Let me close with this, and I want us to have a few more conversation on this. This dysfunctional relationship with culture amplified a cultural captivity. So what that means is that the culture that people found on Noah's Ark became so elevated that it became the culture of Christianity. After all, we're safe in Noah's Ark. This must be a really good culture that God would preserve us. We want to have nothing to do with the culture that is out there. So it elevates the Noah's Ark culture, the culture that is on this ark, as the ultimate culture that is the high point of all culture. So I'll put it in these terms. One of the first books I read in seminary was a book called All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes. I almost dropped out of seminary after reading this book. The book made this assertion. There was something called high culture, and there was something called low culture. High culture, as the author described it, was anything kind of European culture. It was Bach, Beethoven, it was ballet, it was Downton Abbey. You know, that was all high culture. And so anything that comes out of European high culture was considered high culture. And the implication was, it was higher than other culture, therefore it was closer to God. Then you had low culture, which was oftentimes seen as pop culture. And the way Myers described it, it was more low culture in Western context. So it was television sitcoms, it was reality shows, it was popular blockbuster movies. It's Michael Jackson and, how dare he? It was Michael Jackson and Britney Spears. These are all elements of low culture, and this is lower than this culture, and therefore further away from God. Now you can have some argument about, okay, there are elements within Western culture you can say, maybe a little more redemptive, and there are others that might be a little less redemptive. You can have that argument within Western culture. But there was this third step that was problematic. He said, well, you have high culture in the West, you have low culture in the West. What do you do with all the other cultures in the world? So he created a category called folk culture. And everything else fell into the category of folk culture. And that's Native American regalia, African American spirituals and gospels, Korean drumming, fan dancing. All of those things fell into the category of folk culture. And the assumption was folk culture is less than European high culture. And European high culture is closer to God. And in fact, I had a seminary professor tell me, I just get so much more satisfaction out of singing a song in four-part harmony than I do singing Oriental atonal music. I have no idea what Oriental atonal music is, but apparently it's less spiritual than four-part harmony. But there is an assumption that the high culture of the West is better, it's closer to God than all of these other cultures. Again, I reference back to what Richard Tuis is saying. You've come into our communities and said, not only have you brought the message of Jesus, but you couched it in this culture and said, this culture is evil, and you need to be strangers that abstain from their folk culture and instead engage the gospel through the lens of high European culture. And that's where the imposition of Western culture happened. So this is, I would argue, is a very warped theology of culture because it elevates the cultural values of one ethnic group over the values of another ethnic group. Now, why are we talking about this? I'm going to issue a tough challenge. Where are the places where implicitly, not explicitly, you have made these categories a part of your church community? Where are the places where you have said, it's so nice that you bring your folk culture to our community, but at the end of the day, we're going to go to the high culture that brings us really close to God, and a folk culture that is fun to watch from a distance, fun to have on Black History Month, fun to have at special occasions, but at the end of the day, we really get close to God through our European high culture. And in fact, that's the best way to get closer to God. Now, you might not say this explicitly. You might not have that in your vision statement. But where are the places implicitly where these kinds of statements are being made? Where in our actions, which speak louder than our words, we elevate a particular cultural expression as the height of Christianity and therefore relegate all the other Christian expressions, cultural expression, as less than. And maybe something to do on special occasions, but at the end of the day, we really want to make sure that our culture is the one that is elevated in our community. This is the challenge for us. I'm sorry, we're about 8:15 is where we're, who's the timekeeper here? Right, about 5 more minutes. So let me kind of challenge you with this possibility then. Let's start with this. There's a principle in sociology called the brokerage principle. And it started off in the business community. And the business community was looking at the ways, this is the study of a sociologist at Columbia University called, his name is Ronald Burt. I actually had him as a professor when I was a student, and he ended up doing a lot of research in the business community. What he was looking at was who are the best leaders and who are the happiest people in the business community. This was really interesting. So he looked at the way the relationships clustered in the workplace. And so he was asking questions like, who do you have lunch with? Who do you have people over for? Kind of the questions I asked earlier, he asked in the workforce. And he looked at companies and said, you could actually plot where people cluster together. That there's a group of people that people tend to eat lunch with, group of people they invite for barbecues, a work group that tends to cluster together, and found that there are these clusters that exist. Now, typically when you think about people that are happy, people that are good leaders, people that are effective managers, you tend to believe it's the one in the middle of these clusters. And it turns out that they actually are the ones that tend to get promoted faster. Why is that? Because they've built the relationship within that cluster and they get promoted within that cluster. And so you can kind of see, okay, the person that's right in the middle of this cluster might get promoted because he's kind of the center of social life in that cluster. Well, what Burt found was something interesting. He found that, yes, it is true that the ones in the middle of the clusters tend to get promoted, but they're actually not the best leaders. They're actually not the best innovators or even the most happy people. The ones that are the most effective leaders, the best innovators are actually the ones who are on the margins, who cross between the different clusters. So it's the person who might have lunch with the tech crew, but then he invites for a barbecue the janitorial staff. It's the person who, you know, would have the work crew where he works with the tech the managers, but then in the afternoon have a coffee break with somebody else. Or different work groups that do different tasks. It was not the person in the middle who was the most innovative, happiest, most effective leader. It was the person who were kind of here and here and here, because they were going back and forth between different clusters. So here's the challenge then. How is leadership raised up in a church like First Pres? I would argue you probably do the cluster model, where the person who is effective in this cluster is the one that's going to be raised into leadership. Where are you looking in terms of those who are in these clusters, who are able to go between the different clusters? So let me translate this into cross-cultural ministry. I grew up in a Korean immigrant church and a youth group, and we did certain things a certain way because that's what you do in a Korean immigrant church. Then I went to college, and I went to college in New York, and I went to, for the first time in my life, an African-American church. I encountered non-Korean Christians for the first time in my life, and after a year, I was exposed to a whole different world of Christianity in addition to my Korean immigrant church. So that summer, I go back to my home church, and I'm asked as a college student to help out with my youth group that summer, and all of a sudden, I am the most brilliant human being on the face of the planet. Because I've got so many ideas. I've got ideas from all over the place, and I've got idea after idea, and they're saying, where are you coming up with these ideas? Well, the Lord has given me these ideas. But it was actually because I went to a black church and I learned, hey, this is what worship looks like in the black church. Hey, I went to a InterVarsity conference, and they're doing some things here that we never did in the Korean church. So I was brokering innovation, not with new ideas. I was just stealing ideas from other groups. That's why those who operate in multiple clusters are actually the most innovative, effective, and happiest leaders. Because you are not in one cluster and you just kind of hear the same things from the same people all the time. You're actually engaging with other cultures, with other communities that teach you something that you didn't know, and you can bring it back to another community. That again is the challenge of this church. Are there places where you're not kind of seeped in one cultural context and your entire bowl is white marbles, but there are places where there are other influences so that innovation could actually occur because you're learning from different cultural contexts and different communities. And this is one of the ways that I would challenge. This is in my book, Many Colors. I talk about the spectrum of cultures. And these are just a few examples. There's a lot of others, but I picked six of the largest categories that I can think of. There are people in cultures that tend to be individual-oriented, and there are certain cultures that are a little bit more group-oriented. There are cultures that have more direct forms of communication, and there are cultures that have more indirect forms of communication. I'll give you an example of the direct-indirect issue. Direct communication, you kind of talk right face-to-face with each other. I have an Asian-American pastor friend who was talking about a meeting that he went to, and he was talking to a white colleague of his, and he said they were in this room, and they were having coffee, and he said if you had a time-lapse camera stationed at the top, it would literally look like the white man is chasing the Asian man throughout the room. Because the white person as a direct communicator would kind of get right up in his face. And the Asian as an indirect communicator would take a step back. So wait, you're getting a little too close. And then he would get right up in his face and he'll take a step back. And so they're kind of chasing each other throughout the room because he kept taking a step back and kept taking a step back. So you see the difference between direct communication, you get right in their face and talk, and indirect communication, actually we need a little more space. I might not look at you right in the eye because that's not culturally acceptable. I might actually look down. I'm not being rude. It's just my indirect form of communication. But you can see how culturally that might be a contrast, because you're saying, wait, why can't you look me in the eye? Well, that's because my communication is more direct. By the way, this was one of the problems in New York City between the African-American community and the Korean community. The African-American community was more direct communication, and the Asian community, Korean community, the grocers who were there would actually not look them in the eye, but instead look down, and the African-Americans were interpreting that as, you guys are rude, you don't want to look us in the eye. And the Asians were saying, no, that's just our culture. We never look at people in the eye. We always lower our eyes, and so you can see kind of the distinction between direct and indirect communication. equality and hierarchy. Do you assume when you walk into a room that there is kind of an equality in the whole group? Or do you assume that you operate under hierarchical principles? I've been real blessed to be a part of some national boards, evangelical boards. And I've learned this now, but when I first joined these boards, I had no idea what I was doing. I was really nervous. So first of all, I was one of the younger members of the board. I identified to be the only Asian on these national boards. So I go in there, and as an Asian, I operate under the assumption of hierarchy. But all the others, mostly white, operate under the assumption of equality. So I walk into the board meeting, and one of the board meetings, it was the World Vision Board, and Leighton Ford is on the board, and John Huffman, you know, these are giants of the evangelical community, and I'm, you know, 40-year-old, you know, just a kid, and I'm on this board, and I was stunned that people were cutting off Leighton Ford. I mean, what are you doing? This is Billy Graham's brother-in-law. Why are you cutting him off? And they're speaking over each other, and somebody is tailing off, and somebody jumps in before that person finishes. You know what you're talking about. You know what I'm talking about, right? White folks, you are really good at this. You're able to, just as the conversation is winding down, you jump in. Now, as an Asian, I'm listening to this, and when an elder speak, you do not interrupt the elder. You do not jump in with a comment before that elder finishes the comment. In fact, once the elder finishes the comment, you stop, everybody takes a breath, you take a 3-second beat, and you say, okay, let's just sink in, let what Leighton Ford has said, let that sink into our minds and our hearts, and then maybe we'll agree with them about 3 seconds later. That's a hierarchical system. You respect the elders. But in a system of equality, you just jump all over each other, speak over each other, and cut each other off, and that's because everybody's equal. No matter how old a person is or what's one's status in life, you just jump over each other. Now, you can see how, as someone who's coming from a hierarchical system, I would get completely shut out of that conversation. And I actually, from the first meeting, I didn't say a word. I couldn't, because I was waiting for 3 seconds pauses, and everybody was jumping all over on top of each other. So it turns out, ironically, that equality systems, if you assume it, it actually creates a hierarchy. Can you see that? So you say, oh, everybody's equal here, everybody has an equal voice, and we're all equal in God's eyes. But if you assume that and not understand that there are some who are coming with hierarchical worldview, that it actually creates a hierarchy even though you are trying to generate an equality. You see kind of that paradox there. So this is, again, where cultural clashes occur. So there's kind of a list here. I talk about guilt-oriented cultures versus shame-oriented cultures. I'm not going to go into details, but I want to explain it in this way. When you talk about cross-cultural ministry, all of our churches operate in some variation of this. Now, what happens is that over the years, you develop cultural values, and the church begins to reflect that cultural value. So I would argue that most Western churches are more individually oriented than group oriented. Most Western churches operate under more direct forms of communication than indirect, and most operate under a system of equality. They tend to be more task-oriented. So I advise multi-ethnic churches about their board leadership. And I hear this consistently. They say, you know, we always try to diversify our board. We always try to diversify our elder board. And what happens is that the whites always stay for the whole term, but the Asians or immigrants, they usually drop out after 2 or 3 meetings. So I asked them, what did you do during those 2 or 3 meetings that the folks were actually there? Well, at the first meeting, we talked about how thick the cushion should be in our pews. At the second meeting, we talked about what color those pews should be. At the third meeting, we talked about the height of the fence post. And so, okay, how long did you pray? Oh, you know, a couple of minutes at the end. And so I asked them, well, if I were there, I would have probably dropped out after a couple of meetings as well, because you're asking a leader to be task-oriented, to go over the budget and the numbers. And many of these immigrants and ethnic minority leaders are coming in, and they're expecting this to be relationship-oriented. And so when you pray for 5 minutes, it offends the relationship because you're so focused on the task. They're expecting, hey, I'm an elder. I want to pray for 2 hours for the church, not spend 2 hours talking about the budget. So that's where a task orientation might actually contradict with the relationship orientation. So you can kind of go down the list. What I found is that churches pick a spot, and they usually stay there, right? So, you know, if we say individual orientation extreme is 1, extreme group orientation is 10, 1 through 10 again, 1 through 10 again. If we went through this church, we could probably figure out where we fall on the spectrum. We're a 2 here, we're a 3 here, we're a 4 here, we're a 1 here, we're a 4 here, we're a 3 here. You can kind of say the majority of the church falls in a particular spectrum. And it could be a 2 through 4 or a 1 through 3, but you'll probably fall, most folks will fall roughly within a spectrum. Now what happens when you start being a much more multicultural, cross-cultural church, and you have a church that is a 2 here, and all of a sudden you have people that are 7s and 8s show up at the church. Or a church that is a 3 here, and most of your new members are 8s and 9s. And I'm giving these arbitrary numbers. But what happens? So what happens is, 1, the newcomer will adjust and move to be a 2 or a 3, or they'll leave. So, or they'll be outliers for the kind of the remainder of their time, which might not be for very long. So you have a cultural value system in your church that most do not recognize because it's the one that the most of the congregation is already comfortable with. But if you're saying we want to cross cultures, we want to cross socioeconomic barriers, it's not moving the church to a 7 or an 8. It's moving the church to absorb the capacity from just a 3 to a 1 to a 5. To be able to have a broader range of expressions within the church. You can't move the church from a 3 to an 8 overnight. But you can expand a 3 church to a 2-4 church or a 1-5 church. How does that happen? It actually only happens through relationships. It actually only happens through actual encounter cross-culturally, because unless you encounter the otherness, you're not going to have any desire to change. It really comes from relationships. And it goes back to what I said earlier. It comes from being not the one in control, but the one who is the one discipled by someone of a different ethnicity. One who is mentored by someone of a different ethnicity. One who is learning from someone of a different ethnicity. Those are the ways that it really begins to change. So I'll close with this illustration. I started a church in Cambridge, young Asian American, 28 years old, 29 years old when I started the church, and I was way in over my head. And we joke about this now, but my wife and I got married. We met in March, we got engaged in June, and we got married in November. Do not do this, okay? Seriously, do not do this. Do not meet your wife in March and get married in November. Bad, bad idea. It was even a worse idea because I was church planning in my first year of marriage. So I teach a church planning course, and one thing I say, I'm going to start making them sign their name in blood on this, do not church plant in your first year of marriage. You are not allowed to do that. It's just a mess. It's just horrible. So my wife and I, our first year of marriage was extraordinarily difficult. It was a very difficult time for us. And you know, 16 years later, we have a very strong marriage, and we say, man, we earned this thing, so we can enjoy it, because we went through hell our first year of marriage. Now, what happened in our first year of marriage is we didn't really have any role models in our lives. You know, young couple trying to church plant, and we were confused. Again, we barely knew each other in some sense, and so, you know, we had a long-distance relationship in a very short period of time, and we were just beside us. We had nowhere to go. And we reached out to a classmate of mine and my roommate's pastor. His name is their names are Ray and Gloria Hammond. They pastored the Bethel AME Church, an African-American church on the south side of Boston. And they were extraordinarily busy people. Ray is one of the most respected leaders in the city of Boston. He went to Harvard at the age of 16, graduated at 19, went on to be a board-certified surgeon out of Harvard Medical School at the age of 24, 25. And then he said, you know what, I think I want a church plant. And so he went back to Harvard Div School and ended up getting a Harvard Div. So he has 3 degrees from Harvard, and he's also a church planner for the AME Church. His wife is also a medical doctor, went to BU, got her degree in medical school. But what it turned out is that when Ray said, I want to plant a church, Gloria said, no, because I married a doctor, I didn't marry a pastor, and they went through a lot of kind of the similar struggles that my wife and I went through our first year. So we reached out to them, and out of incredible graciousness, Ray and Gloria agreed to meet with us on a regular basis and pray for us as a young couple in ministry. And we have no problem saying we owe our marriage to Ray and Gloria Hammond. Now, it's not, you know, a young Asian couple being mentored by a black couple. That wasn't the issue. We were just desperate. We just wanted somebody in our lives that could minister to us. And it happened that Ray and Gloria Hammond were willing to do that. And they kind of empathized and sympathized with us. But I would tell you that the blessing that we got by being under their leadership has changed our lives. I can also point to Brian Green, who's a bishop of a Pentecostal denomination who happened to be in Cambridge. Brian and Carmen mentored my wife and I as a young couple in ministry. And so we, again, owe our marriage to them. Bill and Polly Amuni McCoy, very small church that they pastored, an African-American couple. Again, they were willing to spend time with us. And in that relationship, we were transformed. We were really blessed by being a part of a community and being led by someone of a different ethnicity than us. And we learned a lot about ourselves and about cross-cultural ministry by being in those kinds of relationships. So I would ask, where are those places where you're encountering those kinds of relationships? Sorry, I went a little bit longer, but let's have some Q&A if we can. Maybe a quick one. Maybe one question. Maybe one theoretical question.
Let's see. Way in the back there.
Yeah. Perception.
Yeah.
Okay. Perception of oneself.
Yeah.
And then thinking about immigrant churches, and I've spent time mentoring youth, quite a few years, youth, high school, and junior high, in a Chinese church here. And I was also thinking of how the youth at, what you said is very true, the youth at First Pres, they're increasingly diverse, and that's not just because of a mix of distinct ethnicities, but because of mixed race children, which is, I think, a very interesting thing to think about, too. I was thinking of all these things and how you have immigrant churches and often the second and third generations become increasingly uncomfortable and they go to different churches. If they want to remain Christian, they go to different churches. Mm. And I think the white church is a kind of a default because as youth and as adults, too, we're constantly negotiating our identifying characteristics.
Yeah.
What stands out? What is going to...
Yeah.
So Christianity is in there.
Yeah.
Ethnic identity is in there. Socioeconomic is in there. And we're just constantly juggling. And so leading me to the question I was having today is, are we... some of your cultures, are they actually leaning towards developing a white church that's less European ethnic and more capable, a healthier white church as opposed to a truly multi-ethnic church?
Yeah.
And how does one get to a truly multi-ethnic church anyway?
That's a great question. And that's the challenge right now. The example that I've used is that there are two fairly dysfunctional models of multi-ethnicity in American history. The first is called the Great American Melting Pot. How many of you remember Schoolhouse Rock? The Great American Melting Pot? Yeah, that was a... We need to pray for a younger generation because you all don't know Schoolhouse Rock. We need to pray for you. You need to... All right. Praise the Lord. So Schoolhouse Rock with the Great American Melting Pot, what happens is all these wonderful cultures get thrown into hot boiling water and melted away all of their wonderful flavors, right? So, and the response to this from my Native friends have been, we Natives don't melt, so stop trying to melt us out. So that cultural idea has been, we can't take that anymore because we're finding that people don't want to lose and have their identity melted away. Then the second model was what now we call the salad bowl. Some of you heard of that illustration as well. And that's an interesting illustration because you kind of think of the salad bowl and you have all sorts of different vegetables in there. You could have romaine lettuce and baby green leaves, and you could have Napa cabbage and kimchi, and you could have jalapenos and collard greens and all these other vegetables thrown in there. They're all of a different flavor and ethnicity. But then you drench it with creamy ranch. I mean, just gallons of creamy ranch on top of that salad. And so no matter how hot a jalapeno is, you put enough creamy ranch, it's going to taste like creamy ranch and not like a jalapeno. So is that actually what we're moving towards, where we end up with, it looks different, the people look different and there are different vegetables there, but ultimately it's still one flavor. I'm trying to think of what's a food illustration, all-you-can-eat buffet, I don't know. Something that shows us that we want to honor the different cultures that are here rather than kind of finding one dominant culture. Now, that's really hard to pull off, and I think churches are starting to investigate what that looks like. And I think you're pointing out the one of the ways that actually worked better is among those who are bicultural. And that's not just Asians and Latinos, but many of us now are operating under a bicultural milieu. We know what it's like to live in multiple worlds. It goes back to that little cluster diagram I showed earlier. Young people are better at doing that. Just because there's kind of more cultural expressions. You can see this in music. So 20 years ago, the genres of music were much more clear and distinct and divided by, frankly, by racial lines, right? Hip hop was for African Americans, you know, heavy metal was for whites, disco chink music was for Asian. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. But there really is a particular genre of Asian dance music. So you have these kind of different genres, but now a lot of these genres are mixed together. You know, you get someone like Eminem, a white boy who raps really well, you know, fairly well. You know, you get kind of the mixture of genres, and so among the young people in musical expressions, you end up with cultures that are blending together a little bit more. And so I think that's, to me, is where some of the hopefulness is, that our young people are actually experiencing this culture milieu a lot more. And that's why, you know, public schools are much more diverse than churches are. And so some of that blending in music and art and literature, they have a much greater sensitivity to that. And I think the culture that emerges out of that biracial, multiracial, cross-racial identity is going to be one of the gifts that I think the next generation is going to give to us.
Maybe we have time for one more question.
I'm kind of getting your message that diversity is based on how we sort and what the proportions are. You talked about this morning, percentage of this, that, and the other. And you had a slide tonight that talked about the three different cultures. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me you got one that you left out, or the author left out, and that's the gay culture. Would you think that 15 to 20% of the people in this country are gay, they're not in any of the lists that we're talking about. And it seems to me the church, as it goes forward, has to really grapple with this. Either they're in or out. And, I it's a tough issue, but I'm not hearing it from you.
Yeah, and I agree that it is a tough issue. The other part of this for me is, I've kind of been still working through this, the ethnic diversity issue also in some areas need to touch on the gender issue as well. And one of the ways that I've been working through that is that they overlap quite a bit. And maybe we can talk about kind of the homosexual LGBTQ community as kind of another layer to that. They overlap quite a bit, but they still have kind of some distinction between these communities. So one of the justifiable critiques of some of my writing is that I focus so much on racial, ethnic, cultural differences that I often don't talk enough about gender differences. So part of my writing right now is to try to understand gender differences a little bit more. My current book is going to talk a little bit more about that. The next project that I'm working on in the upcoming year, we're actually tackling the LGBTQ community and the church's response to the LGBTQ community. So I agree that these are areas that have not been explored as well as they should be. I don't want to conflate these issues too much because I don't think it does justice to those issues if we mix it all together. I remember when I was in seminary, people were saying, well, you got all these different races and ethnicities, just kind of clump them all together and make one category. Well, that's not doing justice to the range of issues within those different cultures. And I would say the same thing about the LGBTQ community. It's the same issue in that I don't want to lump it in with this category in the same way I don't want to lump gender into this category. These communities deserve discussion, conversation in its own right. And that's why my focus now is more on the cultural issue. But I agree with you that that's kind of part of the missing piece of the conversation. But I want to be careful that we don't conflate these issues together.
Well, thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Yeah.